This is Hitchhiking Off the Map.
And you suddenly realize that you're at the mercy of whoever is responsible for your airline ticket. My wife and I were flying back on British Air, and they were great. My mother-in-law had tickets with Air France, and she got up to their counter and they said, "We're sorry, you're American. We're not accepting Americans on the flight." And my mother-in-law said, "Why?" And they said, "Well, we're not going to America at the moment." And she said, "Well, that's fine. My flight stops in Paris. I can stay there." They said, "No, no, Paris is closed. Paris is closed. Paris is closed. Paris is closed. Paris is closed."
Well, hello and welcome. This is Hitchhiking Off the Map. I'm Conrad Bishop.
And Elizabeth Fuller. And this is a show about journeys. No travel tips, sorry. These are the journeys where you didn't get a great vacation package from your travel agent.
Yeah, we don't even offer air conditioning. Although, you know, this is California weather right now.
Yes, it is. This is what passes for winter here.
Meaning it's cold.
And wet.
And wet.
But at least it's not up to your knees.
And so today, stories about stories. What is this strange human urge to tell stories and make movies and do plays and write novels? The stories, the stories, the stories.
Well, actually, what you're doing is just setting yourself up to do what you want to do, which is you want to tell some stories.
Tell some stories, yes.
Yeah, we talked to a person who is a storyteller, and then we have a sketch about what happens when you tell a story at the wrong time, and then we just tell a story.
So let us not ding around philosophizing. It's cold in here. Although, stay tuned for hot breaking information on our amazing story contest. This may not make your life. You know, no promises. I mean, keep on playing the lottery if you do that sort of thing.
First story, Norman Eisley.
We met Norman Eisley at a friend's artist salon that featured music, poetry, comedy, Scottish ballads, and storytelling. He's in the computer industry, don't ask me what he does, and he's a professional storyteller. His own story doesn't really have a strong action plot.
I always joke that I have this nightmare that I'm going to die and I'm going to get to some form of heaven. And there's going to be St. Peter sitting up there with this big book. And he's going to go, "Oh, Norman, you're here. Okay, well, you've sort of lived through however many years of life, and you've seen some of the richest, most happy parts of the world, and you've seen some of the poorest, most miserable parts. You've seen people treat each other great or treat each other awfully. You've seen the best and the worst of the world. And so if you want to get into heaven, Norman, what's the punchline?" I don't know if there is one.
So we talked, and I thought, well, let's not present this as a life story. Let's present it as snapshots, impressions, a life not yet made into a story.
And so he took that spark and he said, "I want you to go down into the world and find out what the most wonderful thing in all of my creation is." And so he took that spark and he sort of shook it up in his hand and then he blew it out over the world. And that spark fell and fell and fell and fell and fell right into the water. My grandfather was an Orthodox rabbi, and I think somehow growing up between the world of very strict Orthodoxy and the world of a city like Los Angeles, where you meet every kind of person, I started just trying to understand what made people tick. And I became fascinated by what gave people faith and hope and gave them a ground from which to decide what they were. And so a lot of my stories sort of explore what lies at the heart of people and their aspirations, their beliefs, their dreams. I lived a year in Beijing, lived 6 years in Taiwan, spent about a year in Israel, have been to Mexico and Guatemala, have been all through Europe, spent some time in communist Czechoslovakia and Yugoslavia before the war. I can actually remember places like Dubrovnik before they were shelled out of Turkey. Let's see. Have been to, well, Taiwan, Japan, Thailand, Indonesia, been on the island of Borneo, which is amazing. That's got to be one of, you know, Nepal, India, Hong Kong, Korea. That was interesting. I was there actually in 1987, just after their protests. I seem to wind up in places just before they change radically. And at that moment, boom, it was swallowed by a fish. And the fish was thinking to itself, "You know, the most wonderful thing in the world has got to be the water. Because I can swim in it, my food is in it, and ooh." And at that moment, that fish bit into a hook. Zzz. Taipei is kind of an interesting world because there's the Chinese population, the Taiwanese population at large, and then there's this small community of expats and students who have come there to study Chinese. And we started organizing these monthly parties. We called the Full Moon Soup Parties. And at the start, what I would do was just invent a kind of soup. That was my contribution. I would invent some soup. Sharon would show some of her new art. And invariably, we would get people who were coming with songs or music. And it grew very, very rapidly. I think we were averaging between 50 and 60 people. I lasted about maybe 3 full moon soups just making soup and then decided I needed to do something else. I wanted to do something creative. And I just had this story that came into my head. And it gives me an idea. And the creator took that spark and he shook it again. And then he blew on it. And when he opened his hand, what came out was the world's first dragonfly. Now, if you know anything about dragonflies, they're born in the water. They spend much of their life on land. As fascinated and enamored with Chinese culture as I was and still am, it is a very self-contained culture. And at the end of the day, you know you're white and you're not part of that culture. After 6 years, I would still walk into stores and people would come racing forward going, I'm sorry, I don't speak English. And they'd say this in Chinese. And I would say, "Mei guan xi, wo hui jiang guo yu. No problem, I can speak Chinese." And they go, "Oh, ni bu ming bai, wo bu hui jiang guo yu, or ying yu. You don't understand. I don't speak English." And I'd go, "等一下, 你现在在讲什么语言? Wait a minute, what language are you speaking right now?" And they'd be like, "Stop." And they'd look at me and their eyes would get wide and they'd go, "Oh, 你会讲国语吧? You can speak Chinese." It was a culture that in some ways was very welcoming, but it always held you at a distance. And it's hard to live a life like that. Now, they watch this thing for a really long time. Generations, in fact. Seeing this bright yellow object fly right over the sun and then make its way. Finally, one day, one very bright little tree frog came to a conclusion. "God, it's God, God." Well, word got round, and after a while, all of these tree frogs started talking to each other. "God, God, 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 God." That's when it started to happen. That bright little tree frog started to climb up the bole of the tree. And the other frogs started to follow him. I think the thing that struck me the most, we always tend to hate the people most who are most like us. It's like there's enough common ground there that we can really spend some time finding out what's wrong with them. Living in Israel and getting to know Israelis and people who had become Israelis and Palestinians, and I got to know a lot of Palestinians, both in Israel and later when I was living in Beijing, I got to know a lot of the people who were studying there who were members of the PLO. These cultures are so much alike that they should be able to get along and work together. And they probably, if they ever get past, you know, the petty hatreds that are kind of exacerbated by people who have political and economic motivations to push this sort of thing. Oh, this region could become so rich. I mean, it could easily lead the world in a way that the Middle East hasn't in eons. I mean, I haven't seen an Israeli or a Palestinian that couldn't roll up their hands and do, you know, a 15-hour day of work and not even blink. I mean, they've got strong work ethic, they've got strong family ethic, and they just are so caught up in not taking responsibility for their own actions and making the other guy responsible that it's sad. It's really sad. It's frustrating to see. I remember when I was in Greece, I was working picking oranges on Crete, and I had been there a while, and I decided I wanted to go over and see Turkey. It was right next door. I had heard Istanbul was incredible. So I announced to all of these friends who were Greek that I wanted to go to Turkey, and they said, "Oh my God, don't go there. Are you crazy? They'll kill you. They'll steal your money. They all carry knives. They're madmen." All right, whatever. I figured I'm 18 years old. I can take care of myself. So I pack up, I go, I have a fabulous time in Istanbul. I announce I'm going back to Greece. I have a bunch of Turkish friends, word for word. "Oh my God, don't go there. They're crazy. They'll kill you. They'll rob you. They all carry knives." It was insane. It was the same story. And they stood on opposite ends of the border going, "Don't go there. That he's crazy. He's evil." "No, he's the same as you." It's just so easy to find fault with the guy that you know best. And after watching that plane, after watching that god, that obviously was bright yellow like he was, for those many, many weeks, he made a decision. "I can be God. God, God, me God, 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 God." And he gathered up his strength, and he tensed up his muscles, and he leapt into the air, and was never seen again. A lot of these stories do the same thing. They just somehow tell themselves. And so in that sense, it is a lot like traveling in the world. You find yourself in a terrain that is alien and yet somehow familiar to you, and you try to get through it in the way that you understand makes the best sense, and hopefully bring back some snapshots of that world that you can share with others, or, you know, that you can sort of bring up to relive it yourself. You see, you gotta scratch beneath the surface, Normie, because they ain't gonna tell you what the truth is. You gotta read between the lines. Now, to be honest, at 12 years old, none of that stuff really stuck with me. I mean, I spent years having Uncle Ted ask me these sort of questions, and most of them didn't mean anything to me. I mean, I heard them, they kind of were there, but they never meant anything. I mean, you know, 12, 13, 14 years old, your concerns are not with scratching beneath the surface of anything. You just want to live your life. During that whole time, I spent a lot of time trying to figure out what I wanted to do with my life. And I was on a trip from Paris down to, I think it was Lyon. And I had this dream where I was basically under this, there was this massive valley. And I was marching in a huge column of soldiers, four abreast. And they were wearing armor and khakis and any military form you could think of. They were wearing some of that armor. And they all looked like they had been through hell. And I'm marching with this group. And looking ahead of me, the column goes forever. And looking behind me, the column goes forever. And I look to my side. And there is this creature in armor that turns to me. And I remember only the terror of seeing this thing. I could not describe it. It just, I felt complete fear. And it said something to me, and I was so frightened by what I was seeing that I just tried to ignore it, and I looked forward again. And obviously, this was not the right thing to do, because it grabbed me, spun me around, and yelled this thing at me, and that's when I woke up. And I just wrote down what it had said. I just scribbled it down on a piece of paper. Now, the thing was that after I woke up and was up for a little while, I don't remember this dream at all. But that day, for some weird reason, I suddenly knew I wanted to study Chinese and Spanish because they were the two major languages besides English that are most used in the world. And I wanted to study computers. I didn't think much about it until I had pretty much finished at Berkeley. And I was getting rid of just a ton of stuff that I had acquired over the years. And I had this one plastic bag filled with just like train tickets and notebooks with stuff I had written down. And I was digging through all of this stuff. It was all this stuff I had brought back with me from Europe. And I found the scrap of paper. And as I looked at it, the first thing that happened was I suddenly remembered the dream. And what I had written using English letters, because it was not anything I could have written any other way at the time, because I didn't know any Chinese, were the words Tian Sha Wei Gong. And it was weird because it wasn't until that moment that it would have made any sense to me, because that was when I could speak Chinese. And what I had written is a phrase that is from Confucius. It means the entire world under heaven is for everybody. So, to me, I mean, at the time, I was so freaked out by it that I immediately tore the paper up. I mean, I was just, the whole thing was just not, But as the years have gone past, you know, I've accepted that there was something there. Now, instead of the newspaper, he had all of his clippings. All of these reviews and articles about him. And he's going through these. And I remember he opened up one and he's like reading through it. And he's going, he's one normie. This guy's talking about oblivion. He's saying, 10 minutes in front of oblivion forces you to encounter the darkest recesses of your own soul. What do you think he's saying about it? What do you think he's saying about me? I remember being in Italy at a youth hostel. It was the first time I had ever been really abroad. And I remember talking to this clerk. And at the time, I was desperately trying to convince him that I was poor like him. I didn't have any money. I was, you know, not rich, and he shouldn't take advantage of me for some reason or another. I think he wanted to charge me a full rate for something. I was trying to bargain with him. And I remember at the time I was incredibly incensed because, you know, he wouldn't buy it. He wouldn't buy any of that. I'm poor like you. He said, there's no such thing. You're American. And it took me the longest time to realize that we live in the Disneyland of the world. When I say that, it's like if you go to Disneyland, even in Long Beach, in California, which is a much smaller place than Disney World, Disney owns property for miles around Disneyland, specifically so that they can set rules like you cannot build a building so tall that you can see it from Disneyland. You cannot build certain kinds of buildings within a certain distance from Disneyland. They control it that tightly because they want to create the feeling like you are in a place and the outside world is gone. It just isn't there. And in America, we are so fortunate and so rich in so many ways we don't get. I mean, even the poorest of the poor in America have clothes on their back and a meal to eat at least once a day, probably twice, usually three times. They have a change of clothes. Even the street people pushing those shopping carts down the street have a change of clothes in many cases, most cases, unless they are, you know, they've lost it and they actively choose not to have them. I mean, there are parts of the world that you can go see today where that's not even an option. Where the pair of clothes that person owns, that's it. That is absolutely it. They can't go to the back of a Salvation Army and pick them up. They can't go to a dumpster behind a McDonald's and pick up a meal. It's just not an option. And we completely miss that every day. When we're criticizing or when we're looking at the rest of the world and how they behave, we're so quick to forget our own history or overlook it because it's embarrassing. The spiritually rich, the fiscally rich, these are the ones that we always say are supposed to be the ones that own up to their responsibilities, good and bad. And yet, we're a nation that's become desperate to make it somebody else's fault. In everything. And I just hope, you know, I'm constantly looking in my stories and in my art and in my travels for a way to communicate to people that there's a world out there that's bigger and wider and deeper than we are, and that our place in it could be so much bigger if we would just take responsibility for our part in it. Well, it didn't take long for those other frogs to talk about it, and one after the other, they decided that they could be God too. So they stepped out on that leaf and leapt into the sky. Now, I'm sorry to say that today, well, there are no little yellow tree frogs in that tree in the heart of Brazil. Oh, well.
In Santa Rosa, California, we were talking with Norman Isley. If you want to get in touch with Norman, just send us an email at info@hitching.org and we'll forward it to him.
This is Hitchhiking Off the Map.